Our reading this evening is from 1 Kings 18, verses 16 to 39, which can be found on page 359 in the Pew Bibles. Elijah on Mount Carmel. So Abadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, the God who answers by fire. He is God." Then all the people said, "What you say is good." Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one of the bulls and prepare it first. Since there are so many of you, call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire." So they took the bull that was given to them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. "Baal, answer us," they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. "Shout louder," he said. "Surely he is a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought, or busy, or travelling. Maybe sleeping and must be awakened." So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes, descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." With the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench round it, large enough to hold two spears of seed. He arranged the wood, cut the ball into pieces, and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, "Fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood." "Do it again," he said, and they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered, and they did it a third time. The water ran down the altar and even filled the trench. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so that these people will know that you, Lord, are God and that you are turning their hearts back again." Then the fire of the Lord fell and burnt up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." There you go. This is the word of the Lord.
Right, there I go. I don't know if you ever have any of those things which you sort of see lying around for a while and you don't really know why they're there, but you can't throw them away. Years and years ago, I went to Twickenham to a rugby match, and while I was there were people giving out stickers. And I just had one thrust in my hand. And I was given this sticker, and I never threw it away. And it must have got just buried in a pile of paper, because when I cleared out my office at school on finishing, it surfaced again. And in the way that only men can, I cleared up by dumping it on the floor upstairs in the spare room. And I didn't really think very much else about it. And then I was down to preach this evening and was, I won't say I was pacing about wondering what to say. It doesn't quite work like that. But I got to the stage of thinking, right, how am I going to talk about this? Last week, Mike Fox was kind enough to build up this evening by saying that he was preaching last week about the B movie, but the grand epic was going to come this evening. And I sat there and just thought, thank you, Mike. Well, I then happened to catch sight of my sticker. And lying on the ground there was this little piece of plastic. And I suddenly thought, do you know, I think I've found a purpose for it. So we're now going to go back to the days before PowerPoint, when we have illustrations. And I'm going to stick my sticker on the front there. And for those of you at the back who can't see it, it simply says, no guts, no glory. So the theme of what I'm going to say is just those four words, three words actually, one of them used twice. No guts, no glory. And you'll see, I hope, as I talk, why. Well, we're in a series of talks on these two prophets, as Helen said earlier, and this evening is our encounter on Carmel. I was thinking, as I was preparing it, my mind wandered to how this episode might be headlined in the press today. Well, that took me off actually having to ever get started. So I came up with some of these ideas. You might like to match them to the quality of the press. Troublemaker returns to confront the government. Would that do? Or how about Carmel rave fails to catch fire? Perhaps nearer the mark. Elijah ignites the crowd. Or my particular favourite, maybe it oughtn't be, no more bull, Baal gets burnt. This evening I want to look at this account and move from simply retelling an Old Testament action story to look more closely at what it can say to us as we go about our day-to-day lives. Apparently, so far away from such an encounter. As Wendy said, if you want to follow it, it's on page 359 in our Bibles. The action takes place in a fairly ungodly place when the government of the day doesn't seem to see the relevance of God to what is going on in their world. Not 21st century Britain, but Israel about 850 BC. Under Ahab and Jezebel, his wife, Israel had got drawn away from God and into giving their attention to idols, particularly Baal. And at this time, their country was literally and spiritually dry. And it's in this context that the encounter, which is the focus of our attention this evening, takes place. After many years away from the country, Elijah meets with Ahab. He accuses Ahab of being, Elijah is accused by Ahab of being the cause of the problems that Israel is facing. But Elijah, rather than accepting this, apologizing and backing down, contests the observation and goes further by issuing the challenge to Ahab and his government. I've not made trouble for Israel, but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's command and followed Baal's. Most of us don't like facing challenges to what we believe. We don't find it very easy, if we're honest, do we? If people can test what we believe, we sometimes struggle to fight back. If we're honest, we'd rather seek a compromise. We perhaps would like to look for common ground, offer excuses, and even squirm and wriggle a little bit and adjust what we think to better suit our accusers. And perhaps it's only afterwards that we might regret our lack of courage and our expediency. And we have a model of that in Peter in the New Testament, when he denies where he's been. But this approach wasn't Elijah's style. Elijah had had enough of Ahab's lack of faith in God and his misguided attempts to put the blame for Israel's plight on his shoulders. He was going to have it out with him. Not for the personal satisfaction or revenge. No, he was committed to doing what he felt God had called him to do. Verse 15, the verse before our passage started, says, Elijah said, "As the Lord Almighty lives, I will surely present myself to Ahab today." And not only that, he was going to make sure that plenty of other people knew about it. "Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." 850 to 1. Elijah clearly wanted to make a point. And moreover, he wanted as many people as possible to witness that point being made. Not many of us are like that, are we? When we need to have a showdown with someone, we often prefer to do it on our own in private. "Oh, could you just come over here? Could I have a word with you? I think that room's empty. Could we go in there?" And we privately discuss our differences. We certainly wouldn't want to do it in public. That doesn't seem to be Elijah's way here, though. No, he wants the world to see what's going to take place. And Ahab seems pretty confident, too. He's happy to play along with Elijah and set up this duel on Carmel. And Elijah is happy for the challenge to be laid down. So Ahab sent word throughout Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between the two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets." Now, I got the impression as I was preparing, this was quite a sort of testosterone-fueled encounter. There was Ahab there saying what he felt, and there was Elijah saying what he felt. It was like two stags getting ready for the rut. They were there just preparing to see things happen. Ahab getting his prophets in place, and Elijah explaining what he believes is his position of strength in weakness. And that's the point. Elijah wants this encounter to play out in this way. Because for God to be shown to be who God is, Elijah needs to create an environment, a stage on which God can perform in a way which entirely contrasts with how people have always believed that God to be.
Elijah wants God to be shown to be who God is. Let's look at what that stage is. Get two bulls for us, the passage says. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves, and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not get fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire. So they took the bull and prepared it. Look at how Elijah sets it all up, using all the elements of Baal worshippers would expect of a religious ceremony. The prophets in charge, the animal sacrifice, and fire. It's as if Elijah is saying to the crowd, I want you to have all the advantage. I want you to play this game on home ground. I want you to do this in front of your supporters. I want you to play to your rules. What he doesn't say, of course, is, I don't want you to have any excuses when you lose. But he is effectively saying, it's all down to you. You choose. You do everything. You have all the power. See where it gets you. And unsurprisingly, the crowd's response was predictable. Then all the people said, what you say is good. Wonder what they were thinking about Elijah. Crackpot. Now, I find the next part of the passage quite challenging. It's all about communication with man, between man and God. Elijah encourages the Baal followers to call on their God to act. They've set up their altar, they've chosen and prepared their sacrifice. Surely all they now need to do is to ask God to act. And how do they do it? They called over many hours. They shouted loudly. They danced. No, don't ask me to. They danced around. They cut themselves. They got frantic. They really went for it, hammer and tongs, using every means they could and every ounce of their energy to get God to do what they want, to do it their way. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. How often do we fall into the same trap? That's a challenging question, isn't it? How often do we want God to do something for us, to confirm our outcome, to do things our way? Have we ever been inclined to set up our altar, to prepare our sacrifice? God, I'll do it this way if you'll do it my way. To pray and pray and pray over hours and hours. To shout loudly. To gesture. To beat ourselves up. To frantically demand of God what we want. And how often could it be said of us that we called on the name of God from morning till noon? God answer us, we shout, but we hear no response and conclude that God didn't answer. What goes through our minds are exactly the thoughts voiced by Elijah in this passage. "Shout louder," he said. "Surely he is God. Perhaps he's deep in thought or busy or travelling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened." But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Those times, aren't they often the greatest tests of faith? Those occasions when we cry out to God to give us what we want, to answer our prayers our way, to obey our orders, to do what we want. And it just doesn't happen. Then Elijah said to the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. After hours of noise, frantic activity, I would imagine the people were tired, confused and subdued, perhaps even feeling a trifle defeated. I would imagine Elijah wouldn't need to shout to make himself heard. A quiet, assured voice would do the job. And as he had their attention, he set about the task of bringing them back to God. They would have probably quietly watched as he took 12 stones, each of them representing a tribe of Israel descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." With the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. He dug a trench around it. He arranged the wood. He cut the bull into pieces and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, "Fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and the wood." "Do it again," he said. And they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered. And they did it a third time. And the water ran down all over the altar and even filled the trench. The only requirement of the watching crowd was to pour cold water on it. It's quite an appropriate metaphor, really, isn't it? And then Elijah prayed. As I was writing this, I thought about those occasions in the Bible, those other occasions when we hear accounts of people praying, trying to get in touch with God. There's encouragement in Ecclesiastes 5, verse 2, to be brief. "Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven, and you are on earth. So let your words be few." Or in Jeremiah 29:13, "You will seek and find me when you seek me with all your heart." Or the reassurance in 2 Chronicles 7:14, "If my people who are called in my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." Or that brief instruction in Psalm 46, "Be still and know that I am God." So how did Elijah pray? Did he feel the occasion demanded a lengthy oration? Did he demand of God any particular outcome? Elijah the prophet stepped forward and prayed, "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. Two short sentences, three references to God, who will decide the outcome, and no reference to what that outcome should be. How would you have felt if you'd been there on Carmel? Passages like this always leave me with questions. Do you think he did shout or just speak quietly? What did the crowd do? Were they silent? Was there any mumbling? What happened next? Well, we know that. But was it instantaneous? As soon as Elijah had got that last word of the prayer out, whap, down came the flames. Was it that sort of moment? Or was there one of those pauses? Producers use them on programs these days when they decide the outcome. You know, when they had to wait. Elijah had prayed. Well, what's happening? Nothing's happening. Well, he's a fraud, isn't he? We don't know. Perhaps even they were questioning whether anything would happen. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burnt up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. The heat of that must have been amazing. The heat of that moment would have got them all turning away. We've been too close to bonfires, we know that. It would have been bright too. It would have probably by this time have been dark, so the sudden contrast between the darkness and the light would have been intense. Their eyes couldn't take it in. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." Now, I was tempted to leave it there, to accept that the climax of the passage really said it all. When the people saw this, they cried out, "He is God." Job done. But that's not really the end, is it? Life, as we say, goes on. We face our Carmels every day. When we go into the world, we are challenged about our faith. Not necessarily in confrontations, where people step up in front of us and say, "Are you a Christian?" Probably quietly we say, "Thank goodness for that." But perhaps in the values that we see around us, the priorities that our friends and work colleagues and other people that we see have as their priorities, the behavior of those around us, the messages of the media, the events of the wider world, the circumstances of our friends and family. They're all our Carmels. They're all our occasions when our values, our beliefs, what our God stands for, are confronted. How should we face them? We may not feel like Reigate Elijah, but we should have the guts. Got to my sticker. And certainly, whether we're loud or quiet, we should pray. And we should know that God will answer in his way to his glory. No guts, no glory.